Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. 6 minutes after the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and AirAmericaRadio.com. Our question for this first hour, is the press in the United States, either by acts of omission or commission, is the press in the United States setting up the destruction of American democracy, of the experiment of the great and noble experiment of American democracy? I just want to go through some of these, you know, just kind of a general overview of some of this stuff. There's also a whole lot of other stuff in the news that we will be getting to as well. By the way, for example, the Bush administration has just now come out with a new national security strategy saying, bomb first, ask questions later, that's our policy. Preemptive attacks. Now, you recall, before George W. Bush came along, the last national leader to claim that preemptive attacks were appropriate was Adolf Hitler when he attacked Poland in 1930, I think it was 39. So it's been a while. But, you know, it's our path and we're going to stay to it. Well, our path is not going so well. And when we look back, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, has just compiled some of the Iraq War's Pollyanna pundits, just a marvelous little selection here. Syndicated columnist Cal Thomas, for example, on April 16th, 03. Now, keep in mind, this is, you know, just after the war had begun. He says, all of the printed and voiced prophecies should be saved in an archive. He's talking about people like me who were out there on the streets. We had the largest outpouring of human beings in the history of this planet protesting something, protesting the possible invasion of Iraq by the United States. And what were we saying? We were saying, if we invade the United States, we're going to be putting our soldiers at risk. We are going to be involving ourselves in what will ultimately become a civil war. We are going to inflame the Muslim world against us. You're going to have our soldiers involved in house-to-house combat. And they were all saying, get over it. In fact, the Bush administration is still doing this crazed policy. Right this minute, as we speak, the U.S. military has just launched its biggest air offensive in Iraq since the 2003 invasion of that country. They're trying to bomb them into submission. I'm telling you, you can't bomb people into submission. You can only awaken them. People say, well, what about World War II? What about Germany and Japan? Germany and Japan were both in the grips of cults. The cult of emperor worship in Japan, where people were willing to die on behalf of the emperor, proudly fly suicide planes onto the decks of U.S. aircraft carriers. When those people saw the rape of Nanking, the destruction of cities in China, the horrible war crimes that the Japanese had committed during World War II, they were horrified. They immediately stopped. My father was part of the occupation forces in Japan immediately after the war. I asked him one time, I said, how did they respond to you? He said, they welcomed us. They welcomed us. Not one single U.S. casualty in Germany or Japan after the end of World War II. It wasn't because we bombed them into submission. It was because they figured out that what they were doing, what they had done, what their governments had done, what the government of Japan had done, what the government of Germany had done, was they had launched wars of aggression, and they were engaging in international crimes. And the people said, oh, God, I can't believe we did this. I am so sorry. By and large. But this is a lesson that apparently has not been figured out by the Bush administration, perhaps because the Bush administration is making, in some ways, the same mistakes that Germany and Japan made, thinking that they can aggressively, preemptively be the first to bomb and get people to say, oh, okay, we'll go along with you. You bombed us enough. ain't going to work. Our launching the biggest air offensive in Iraq since the 2003 invasion of the country will, I predict, speed up the civil war in Iraq, because it's going to further radicalize everybody. And it's going to further diminish the credibility, what little credibility it has, tragically, of the government that was just recently elected, because that government is increasingly being perceived from all sides as being a tool of the Americans. So anyhow, back in April 16th, 2003, syndicated columnist Cal Thomas, one of the more toxic of the cons out there, he said, all of the printed and voice prophecies should be saved in an archive. When these false prophets again appear, they can be reminded of the error of their previous ways and at least be offered an opportunity to recant and repent. Well, Cal, we're looking for your recantation and your repentance. Headline, April 10th, L.A. Times. Iraq is all but won. Now what? Joey Chen, reporter on CBS, May 4th, 2003. Now that the combat phase of the war in Iraq is officially over, what begins is a debate throughout the entire U.S. government over America's unrivaled power and how best to use it. This was not just in the mainstream corporate media. NPR's Bob Edwards, April 28th, 2003. He said, Congress returns to Washington this week to a world very different from the one members left 2 weeks ago. The war in Iraq is essentially over, and domestic issues are regaining attention. Tony Snow, Tony's kind of pathetic, but Tony Snow, Fox News Channel's Tony Snow, he says, Tommy Franks of the coalition forces have demonstrated this on April 27th, 2003, have demonstrated the old axiom that boldness on the battlefield produces swift and relatively bloodless victory. The three-week swing through Iraq has utterly shattered skeptics' complaints. Yeah. Tell that to the as many as 100,000 Iraqis who died in that, Tony. Charles Krauthammer. He said on April 19th, the only people who think this wasn't a victory are Upper West Side liberals and a few people here in Washington. Yeah, a few of them. Howard Fineman, Newsweek's Howard Fineman on MSNBC said, we had the controversial wars that divided the country. This war united the country and brought the military back. Yeah. Chris Matthews, April 9th, 2003. We're all neocons now. On May 1st, Matthews said, we're proud of our president. Americans love having a guy as president, a guy who has a little swagger, who's physical, who's not a complicated guy like Clinton or even like Dukakis or Mondale, all those guys, McGovern. They want a guy who's president. Women like a guy who's president. Check it out. The women like this war. I think we like having a hero as our president. It's simple. We're not like the Brits. Yeah. Chris Matthews, who it now turns out, the president of MSNBC, Rick Kaplan, says, totally untrue, totally, that Matthews might have taken as much as $35,000 to speak to the National Venture Capital Association and fees to speak to other right-wing groups. Impossible. But now the National Venture Capital Association has confirmed to Think Progress, thinkprogress.org, that in fact Matthews was paid $35,000. The last year and a half, we've seen a radical swing to the right on the part of Matthews, and at the same time, a lot of speeches and apparently a lot of money. Anyhow, CNN's Lou Dobbs on Bush's Mission Accomplished speech. He looked like an alternatively commander-in-chief rock star, movie star, and one of the guys. Chris Matthews, why don't the damn Democrats give the president his day? He won today. He did well today. April 9th, 2003. Judy Woodruff, CNN. If image is everything, how can the Democratic presidential hopefuls compete with a president fresh from a war victory? Well, as I've been saying all along, that was Bush's strategy. This war was all about getting elected. It was all about the build-up to it in 2002 was all about taking back the Senate from the Democrats, and the war itself was all about the 2004 elections. And we were all but told that by these people. Alan Colmes on Fox News, he says, this was April 25th, 2003. He says, now that the war in Iraq is all but over, should the people in Hollywood who oppose the president admit they were wrong? Yeah. Joe Scarborough on the 10th of April. I'm waiting to hear the words I was wrong from some of the world's most elite journalists, politicians, and Hollywood types. I just wonder who's going to be the first elitist to show the character to say, hey, America, guess what? I was wrong. He goes on to say, do you remember Scott Ritter? You know, the former UN chief weapons inspector who played chief stooge for Saddam Hussein? Well, Mr. Ritter actually told a French radio network that, quote, the United States is going to leave Baghdad with a tail between its legs defeated, end quote. Sorry, Scott. I think you've been chasing the wrong tail again. Yeah. Good old Joe Scarborough. Who, by the way, had a female aide die mysteriously in his office. It was a whole other thing, but interesting that that was never seriously investigated. While we're still looking at Aruba. Anyhow, Scarborough continues, many disgraced commentators and politicians alike, like Daschle, Jimmy Carter, Dennis Kucinich, and all these others, will step forward tonight and show the content of their character by simply admitting what we already know, that their wartime predictions were arrogant, misguided, and dead wrong. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. George Bush doesn't think that way. He'd rather leave with everyone afraid than handle things the American way. But fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great.
No, it didn't. Welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. The Tom Hartman radio program helping you win the water cooler wars. We've been chronicling the rise of the war and how the press, right across the board, the press was basically playing handmaiden to the Bush administration. No problem. Everything's good. But Bill O'Reilly, for example, Fox News Channel of February 10th, 2003. There's no way. There's absolutely no way. They may bomb for a matter of weeks, try to soften them up as they did in Afghanistan, but once the United States and Britain unleash, it's maybe hours. They're going to fold like that. Christopher Hitchens, in a February 28, 2003 debate. This is, again, the run-up to the war. He says, this will be no war. There will be a fairly brief and ruthless military intervention. The president will give an order. The attack will be rapid, accurate, and dazzling. It will be greeted by the majority of the Iraqi people as an emancipation, and I say, bring it on. Yes, Christopher Hitchens. He's so wise. This is the tragedy. The tragedy of what brought this about. Mara Liasson, NPR. Where there was debate about whether or not Iraq had these weapons of mass destruction and whether we can find it, she asks Brittium. No, there wasn't. Nobody seriously argued that he didn't have them beforehand. Nobody. Excuse me, I did. Scott Ritter did. Hans Blix did. Hans Blix, before the war, was saying, you know, the people who believe in weapons of mass destruction are not that different from people during the Inquisition who believed in witches.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
And now we have this absolute tragedy. Today, Al Jazeera is reporting, with the cold Mosul winter winds lashing against his reddened face, Qatim Ma'ad embraced his wife and promised they would meet once again when he resettled in Jordan. Our question, is the press, is the American press, setting up the destruction of democracy in the United States? Our question for this hour. The Al Jazeera story, the story about how the whole country, he says, I knew the whole country would descend into chaos as he sipped his traditional Iraqi tea. I refused to raise my family, my two sons, in the despair most of us knew was coming. He's living in Rod, the capital of Jordan. He's living in the capital of Jordan. Rod is his name, excuse me. A few weeks after Baghdad fell, his wife and two sons joined him in Amman, and a family has since applied for refugee status in the U.S. Tens of thousands of mostly young Iraqi professionals, artisans, musicians, college professors, and doctors have left in search of security and stability abroad. Yes, we are bringing freedom to Iraq. In the meantime, here in the United States, Senator Russ Feingold says Bush is denying freedom to the United States, to citizens of America. that George W. Bush has engaged in a wiretapping program which is illegal. Just plain old, flat out, straight up, illegal. And, you know, Feingold, unembarrassed, unabashed, comes right out and says it. And the Washington Post, on a front page story today, front page story yesterday in the Washington Post, spins this thing backwards. Spins it backwards. First of all, here's Russ Feingold speaking about Bush.
Now, the facts are pretty straightforward. Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, nearly 30 years ago to ensure that as we wiretap suspected terrorists and spies, we also protect innocent Americans from unjustified government intrusion. Mr. President, FISA makes it a crime, to wiretap Americans on U.S. soil without the requisite warrants, and the President has ordered warrantless wiretaps of Americans on U.S. soil, so it's pretty simple. The President has broken that law, and that alone is unacceptable. But the President did much more than that. Not only did the President break the law, he also actively misled Congress and the American people about his actions. And then, when the program was made public about the legality of the NSA program, he has fundamentally violated the trust of the American people.
Period. And I got to tell you about this new Pew study, the language that Americans are using now to describe this. But yesterday, the Washington Post, in talking about this, talking about why Democrats are not supporting Feingold, they said Democrats are wary of polls showing that a majority of Americans side with the president on wiretapping tactics. Actually, the polls show that the majority of Americans are opposed to the president's wiretapping tactics. CBS News poll conducted February 22nd, 51% said the president does not have the legal authority to wiretap us without a warrant. A Quinnipiac University poll conducted February 21 through 28, 55% of Americans said the government should get court orders for this kind of surveillance. How can the Washington Post be running these kinds of stories that says that a majority of Americans side with the president on wiretapping tactics when we don't? And the polls show that we don't. It's like the press is like framing the issues for the Democrats and the Republicans in advance and saying, here's how people feel. And it's not true. This is incredible. Got another poll for you. Is the press trying to destroy democracy in America? 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
They sell us the president the same way. They sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. The same time they sell us our war. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lies in the balance.
Lives in the Balance, Jackson Brown. By the way, if you go to TomHartman.com and right up the top of the page, you can go to JacksonBrown.com for that matter. You get it right from the source. I also put a link to his new video. This is just absolutely extraordinary up at the top of our webpage. The Senate just voted on raising the debt ceiling, by the way, to stave off the possibility of bankruptcy by this government. Or default, let's say. It wouldn't be bankruptcy, it would be default. But welcome back to the program, by the way. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And if you want to drop by our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. It'll get you in there. The raising the debt ceiling so that George W. Bush, when he came into office, this country owed the rest of the world and itself. Basically, the government was in debt to the tune of $5.2 trillion, as I recall. A little over $5 trillion. Well, we're now pushing 9. 6, 7, 8, yeah. We're now pushing $9 trillion. So whenever anybody says to you, oh, look at Bush has made a pretty good economy, what your response should be automatically and instantly is, yeah, give me a credit card with a $3 trillion credit limit on it, and I'll show you what it looks like to live large. I'll show you a country that looks like it's doing okay. This is insane. Who's going to pay this bill? Well, I'll tell you, it's you, me, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. What do they have? What possible shred of sanity could do this? To borrow $3 trillion in order to fund tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And, of course, what we're seeing is that the millionaires and billionaires are getting richer and richer, and everybody else is getting wiped out. Well, to what extent is the press playing a role in that? By the way, this was passed with not one Democrat voting for it. Not one. In fact, two Republicans voted against it. Ensign of Nevada and Burns of Montana. I don't know Ensign's status. I do know Conrad Burns is running scared. So you got two Republicans who voted against it, but the vote was 52 to 48. Of the 54 Republicans in the Senate, 52 of them voted to raise the debt ceiling, borrow more money, keep it looking good. No, we're not going to raise taxes. No, we're not going to cut back on spending. We're just going to borrow and spend, borrow and spend. So anyhow, as a consequence of this, as a consequence of the war, the economy falling apart, people are starting to figure this stuff out. And CBS did a poll back in February, the last week of February, February 28th. They did a poll asking Americans, well, what do you think of Bush? How's he doing? Lowest approval rating ever, 34%, or ever for Bush. And everybody freaked out on the right, all these guys on the right, the Cybercast News Service, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Britt Hume, John Gibson, all of them ranting about the fact, that 37% of the people surveyed were Democrats, 28% were Republicans. Now, when you do a survey before you do a survey. You find out, you know, what are the relative proportions out there? And right now, it turns out, if you ask Americans, are you a Democrat or Republican, 37% of them will say I'm a Democrat, 28% will say I'm a Republican. So that's what they looked for. Well, CBS got all kinds of flack for this. So they went back and they asked for a 50-50. 50% Republicans, 50% Democrats. Guess what? It's still 34% support the president. So Limbaugh attacked this poll. Hannity attacked this poll. All of them said, you know, this is Hannity. You know, the first thing you find out is it's a 2-to-1. They polled Democrats. Limbaugh is saying, this is not a representative of the population in this country in any way, shape, manner, or form. Nor is the fact that Bush has 34%. You know, it's not possible. Simply isn't possible. He called it a bugged poll. Yeah, right. Well, here's what really amazes me. This really amazes me. In 2003, in May of 2003, the Pew Center for People in the Press, the Pew Research Center for People in the Press, impeccable. Unbiased, nonpartisan. In May of 2003, they asked Americans, give us a one-word description of George W. Bush. The top three words that came up were good, Christian, and honest. 52% of Americans used one of those three words. They repeated the poll in March of this year. This month, they repeated the poll. The number of Americans, the percentage of Americans who describe George W. Bush now as good, Christian, or honest is down to 28%. 10% use a neutral word like, oh, he's president. 14% have no answer. But 48% of Americans used one of three words to describe George W. Bush. And this brings us back to the press, because I guarantee you, you're going to see one of these three words in the press when they talk about this Pew poll, because they have to talk about it. I mean, this is a big deal, but you're not going to see the other two. Another example of the press censoring itself because it is terrified of the blowback it's going to get from the Reich. The three words that 48% of Americans, the top three words that 48% of Americans said came to mind when they were asked, what word comes to mind when you hear the phrase President Bush, President George W. Bush, the three words were incompetent, idiot, and liar. These are not my words. Well, I wouldn't disown them, but I'm not, you know, and the Pew poll, folks, they didn't call up people and say, do you think Bush is an incompetent idiot liar or a good Christian honest? It wasn't that. They called up people and they said, what's the first word that comes to mind when you hear the George W. Bush, when you think of George W. Bush? And the top three words in 2003 were good, Christian, and honest, and the top three words today are incompetent, idiot, and liar. A significantly higher, reading from the poll itself, or from the summary of the poll, published by the Pew Center, people-press.org, you can find the study. A significantly higher percentage of Americans believe that Bush is out of touch with what is going on in the government than said that about former President Reagan during his second term in August of 1987, when Reagan had Alzheimer's. This is just the single word most frequent. This is, I'm quoting from the study. The single word most frequently associated with George W. Bush today is incompetent, and close behind are two other increasingly mentioned descriptors, idiot and liar. All three are mentioned far more often today than a year ago. He also has an approval rating of 33% in this poll. Although, here's the proof that what I said the Republicans were doing is working. I said that the Republicans in Congress are going to run against Bush. And Bush is going to help them because he doesn't want to be impeached. He doesn't want the Republicans to lose Congress. And Karl Rove is going to help it happen because he doesn't want to go to prison. They want to hold the House and the Senate in Republican hands. Most Americans, 58%, believe Congress acted appropriately in strenuously opposing the Dubai ports deal. So the approval of Congress is now up to 58%. The Republicans are discovering, hey, run against Bush. And Bush is saying, yeah, do that. Because I don't want to be impeached. Leonard in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Leonard, what's on your mind today? Leonard?
Yes?
Yeah. Whoops, I think I just put you on hold. We'll pop you back in there. Hey, Leonard, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi there. Love your show. You're very informative, and everybody says that, but it's very true. I think the mainstream media is incredibly implicated in the demise of democracy. There's a litany of unanswered questions. I mean, and it approaches, you know, what happened with the beginning, at the beginning of your show, when you read for 10 minutes quotes from some of these guys.
Yeah.
There are questions about, you know, what was the deal with Saddam taking apart his Scuds 3 weeks before the war began, and Bush just shrugged it off.
Yeah.
What
and Al Baradei running around saying there's nothing we can find, and Rumsfeld saying, oh, we know where they are, and Hans Blix says, tell us, we'll go find them.
Right, but I want us to look at those again. Now, as Democrats or as independents or as people in the opposition, we have to stop talking to these guys on their terms. We have to stop talking to them about whether the war was justified. We have to get past that and say, why did you go in?
But see, here's where it gets even weirder, Leonard. The Bush administration just published their new national security, whatever you call it, national security policy in the United States. This is the second one in the 5 years that Bush has been president.
Correct.
And they reaffirmed the right to launch preemptive strikes. And in fact, they went beyond that. They said that Iran is the country likely to present the single greatest future challenge to the United States. And when Stephen Hadley was asked about it, he said that sentence applies to both Iran and North Korea. They also warned China. They're threatening China. This is like threatening the guy who owns your mortgage.
I understand. I mean, what thinking person cannot understand that the country, the U.S., with the largest, who spends more on defense than the rest of the world combined, when you decide to go preemptive, you aren't as effective as any terrorist group in fomenting fear.
Yeah. Well, that's their goal. And Leonard, thank you for the call. We got to take a break. But their goal is that they think that they can make countries so fearful that they will do what we want. But the reality is that by and large, that's not what happens. What instead you get is reaction and anger. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You see everything. You see everybody. You
it's even reached the point now. Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. It's even reached the point where Jessica Simpson today turned down an invitation to meet with George W. Bush. You've been invited to meet the President of the United States. I think I'll pass. Jessica Simpson. And I guess I'm admitting to a certain amount of culture ignorance. It's how little television I watch. I used to think Jessica Simpson was Bart's sister. I've since been corrected on that, so I guess I know the truth now. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Paul in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I'd like every Democratic hopeful for 2008 to know that if you don't back Senator Feingold on this, I don't want to hear from you.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Where's John Kerry on this issue? Don't even bother running if you don't even support him on this.
Ditto.
We got to get some tough candidates in here.
Yep.
Nancy Pelosi must go. We need to get somebody with some balls in there.
Well, I wouldn't make it a gender thing, but yeah.
No, not a gender. I mean, you know.
I know what you meant, Paul.
Yeah.
Okay. No offense on behalf of women intended.
Should be their acid test as a candidate.
There you go. Good. Well said, Paul. Thank you very much. Harrison in Rutherford, Texas. Hey, Harrison.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Harrison?
Well, I'm a high school newspaper editor, and this town I live in is so small it's pathetic, and it's really conservative. It's sickening. And everything that we are going to put in the paper, it has to go before the school board, and they have to approve it before it can get printed. And, you know, it's a high school newspaper. Most of the people are going to write about junk.
Yeah, but, well, you know, that's high school.
Yeah, exactly. But those of us that write about political stuff, they only let the conservative stuff get printed. They never print any of my articles. I wrote one about Cheney shooting the guy and how, with the distance that it is,
mm-hmm.
if you're shooting a gun and you can't tell you're shooting at a person, you don't need to be shooting a gun, and that's all I basically stated.
Yeah, yeah. They censored it. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Harrison. I mean, bottom line, in my world, my book is Cheney was drunk. I mean, it's just that simple. Thomas in Hayward, Wisconsin. Hey, Thomas.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was telling your screener that I think you're as complicit as some of the other media in helping erode our American institution.
How so?
Well, how do you feel about Osama bin Laden? I would say that the media has convicted this person in absentia without a trial. Growing up in the United States, I learned that a man is innocent until proven guilty, and this is one of our beacons of freedom.
Yeah, I've said on this program several times, Thomas, that there is evidence, apparently evidence, that Osama bin Laden was behind this. Frankly, I don't think he knew that it was happening. I mean, he was helping to fund these things, apparently. But, yeah, there hasn't been a trial. He hasn't been convicted. This is why I've been saying this thing should have been treated as a crime from the beginning. We needed to do with whoever it was who did this, presumably Osama bin Laden, but we don't know for sure, the same thing that was done with Tim McVeigh, which is, you know, track down a criminal, hold a trial in open court, present the evidence, and if you've got enough evidence to convict, you have a jury convict them.
Well, when anyone in the media links Osama bin Laden with 9/11 without that trial,
yeah,
we're still putting out in the American mind that this man is guilty without a trial.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Thomas, but I don't think that makes me complicit with the American media and destroying democracy. I'm sorry, I'm not going to go there. Dan in Sicklerville, New Jersey, and it's not like I don't mind, you know, I don't mind being criticized if there's some coherence to the criticism. Anyhow, Dan, what's up?
Tom, how's it going?
I'm fine. What's up?
Hey, I'm at work today, and yeah, I've been in the corporate atmosphere for about 10 years now, and I received a weird email today. I wanted to bounce it off you and get your thoughts on everything. I got an email from HR today saying that the Office of the Secretary of Defense has contacted the company and requested the number of Guard and Reserve employees in our organization.
Yeah, they're getting ready for the war in Iran.
You think that's what it is?
That's absolutely what it is.
What it was, and if this was something that the government normally did, regularly did? Or
no. Not to the best of my knowledge.
Put it out there that it's happening. Get from you what you thought it might be for.
Yeah, that's what I think it is. I think that Bush's numbers are in the tank, and so he's trying to gin up a new war.
So let me ask you this: I've initiated the process of with my HR department to try and have the letter made available to all the employees in the organization. You recommend like any way to go about something like that? Or?
I don't know. I don't know if this is one of those things where you can't legally share it or not, and I've never worked in a large corporation that had large enough to have an HR department before. I'm clueless, frankly, about the politics of that, Dan. But I wish you well in passing the word along.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. Charles in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Charles.
Hey, I apologize for getting a little off point, but I spoke with you earlier about problems I sensed with Hillary Clinton. Do you sense the same problems with Al Gore as far as presidential candidate?
Not now. I did before back in 2000. And in 99, I felt that Gore was really kind of part of the establishment, and he was, you know, going down the DLC road along with Bill Clinton. I think Al Gore has been radicalized, seriously radicalized, in part by having an election stolen from him, and in part by just watching the way that this country is slip-sliding away.
I think he's a straight arrow, play-by-the-rules kind of guy that this country is ready for.
I agree. I would vote for Al Gore. I would campaign for Al Gore in a second, in a heartbeat.
I think Gore Feingold in the next come election would be hard to beat. Also, before I get off track, do you have a Diebold update for me? What's going on with these voting machines? Because it'll be pointless unless we get some kind of
Well, it's not pointless. I mean, you never give up. That's what they want you to. The number one message that the cons want us all to be believing is that, hey, there's no point in voting. So, you know, with regard to Diebold updates, I don't have a particular one for today, but I'll tell you that, you know, the battles are still going on. Down in Ohio, a third elections official now has been indicted for crimes having to do with the elections of 2004. Whether those have to do with Diebold or not, I don't know. But I think the American people are waking up. Across California, people are really getting fried by this thing. So very, very upset about it. So we'll see how it shakes out. Increasingly, the question to ask is not, is it Diebold or not? That's sort of like asking, is it Bush or not? It's not about Bush. It's about conservatives. It's not even about Republicans. And it's not about Diebold. It's about whether or not corporations should be involved in the voting process at all. And they shouldn't be. They should not be. This is part of the commons. This is our government. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the real free speech zone. No RNC pass required, no barbed wire. This is it right here. Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman radio program. Welcome back to our program, my friends. Ultimate Sacrifice. John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of JFK. A new book written by Lamar Waldron and some guy named Tom Hartman. And Lamar Waldron is with us. Hey, Lamar.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here.
Great to have you back. This week is Sunshine Week. Tell us about it.
Well, that's correct. That's a lot of journalism agencies, media organizations, newspaper groups. This is the second annual Sunshine Week when the focus in a lot of those organizations is on government secrecy and how we can have more openness in government. And it's just so ironic that in Sunshine Week, when the focus is on government secrecy, that there's just so much in the news now about government secrecy. I mean, from the NSA domestic spying to just the general increase in secrecy by the Bush administration, the national security whistleblowers, people who get punished for trying to expose top secret wrongdoing, and now the reclassification of files that the CIA and other organizations have released in some cases years earlier. Now they're putting those back to make them secret again. So much of this is in the news during this week, and what a lot of people don't realize is how much a lot of this secrecy by a lot of the same agencies, and in some cases some of the same people, has been going on for years, and it actually goes back to much of the secrecy surrounding things having to do with John F. Kennedy.
And the assassination of John Kennedy.
That's correct. And this top secret plan that JFK had to overthrow Castro and invade Cuba on December the 1st, 1963, they had lots of plans to keep that plan secret. Obviously, they did a great job because it stayed secret until our book, stayed secret from many congressional committees who looked into those actions. But when you have the same people and the same agencies keeping so much secret for so long, they just get used to it. It almost becomes a right, something they expect. But now, thanks to a lot of people, Representative Shays and Kucinich and their committee, people are starting to look at these things and realize, you know, that the secrecy has been going on for a long time. And of course, my feeling is until we can get everything exposed about what JFK was doing in relation to Cuba and how the mafia was able to infiltrate that and how the CIA had to cover a lot of that up, things that are still secret after 40 years and a million documents still to be released, you know, how can we possibly expect to know what's going on with Iraq and 9/11 and Afghanistan and those kinds of things?
Lamar, you and I spent 7 years banging our heads against this, and then you continued for another 10 years after I moved away from Atlanta, going through massive government libraries, going through files, going through computer databases, sitting in front of old what were those machines called that showed the film strips?
Oh, the microfilm.
Microfilm, thank you. These old microfilm machines, you know, just with our eyes just blurring after hours and hours of reading old newspaper stories and government documents and things, and it took 17 years.
That's correct.
To crack this story, and this is a 40-year-old story. Do you have any sense of whether it's going to be easier or harder for people, for the next generation of researchers, for the people who are doing what you and I did with the Kennedy assassination, who are going after, for example, 9/11, any sense of what it's going to be like and how long it's going to take?
Well, it's actually up to the people out there, the people listening today. You know, there are people that care. Again, Shays, Kucinich, and the others on their committee, you know, they've been looking into this. They just held hearings on Tuesday and allowed me to contribute some information about the reclassification. You know, if not for those guys, the CIA would get to not only keep from releasing material in the first place, and there's still a million files about the JFK assassination alone they're keeping.
And we're talking literally 1 million, one with six zeros after it.
And we're not talking pages, we're talking files, and that doesn't come from us. That comes from OMB Watch. You can look at OMBWatch.org, very respected government watchdog group. You know, they got it from one of the officials, and it's just amazing. That's still secret, but now the CIA has been, for the last few years, going back into the National Archives. They and the Defense Intelligence Agency and other, and the FBI, set up their own office in the National Archives to reclassify information that had been classified before. And, of course, you and I made much, much use of information that kind of slipped out in the 90s. I worked a lot behind the scenes to get officials to identify more of those records. But it's actually up to the people out there, because I can give you a great example. You and I were looking through that newspaper microfilm because so much was still secret in the early 90s before the JFK Act got passed when the Oliver Stone movie came out, that, you know, if you couldn't get to the documents, at least you could look at the old newspaper files. And you and I found, just from looking through those newspaper microfilm rolls, an actual attempt to assassinate JFK in Tampa, Florida, 4 days before Dallas, that had never been revealed to the Warren Commission, to any of the congressional investigators.
It was just a little story in a newspaper that ran one day, and then they pulled the thing because the government,
exactly,
the giant foot stepped on them.
There was no word at the time. The day after JFK's assassination, tiny article. The next day, Miami Herald tried to follow that up, and everybody clammed up. But we were able to dig that information out. But now here's something, you know, very sad, too, is that That one little newspaper story actually quotes a Secret Service file about the suspect in Dallas and the Tampa attempt. That file no longer exists. It was destroyed in 1995, 3 years after Congress passed a law saying all these files had to be released.
Well, it was destroyed right after you asked for it in writing, wasn't it?
Well, I had informed the JFK Assassinations Records Review Board, this official group appointed by Clinton, created by Congress. I and another historian had told them about this Tampa attempt, and lo and behold, 6 weeks later, the Secret Service says, you know, we just destroyed those files. But it's even sadder than that, Tom, because there was a Secret Service agent, America's first African-American Secret Service agent to protect a president. This was Abraham Bolden, based in Chicago at the time, was appointed to the White House detail by JFK himself, helped to protect JFK. And Bolden had been part of stopping an earlier assassination attempt 3 weeks before Dallas in Chicago, when JFK had to cancel his motorcade and his whole trip at the last minute. And Bolden had also been told about the Tampa attempt, very similar, you know, 4 days before Dallas. And Abraham Bolden realized a few months after the assassination that the Warren Commission hadn't been told about the Chicago attempt or the Tampa attempt and some other Secret Service laxity. He was an early whistleblower. So he went to Washington to tell them. The very day he went to Washington, he was arrested on trumped-up charges that we explain in the book, and we name names, by the Chicago Mafia, these same mobsters like Johnny Roselli, who had infiltrated JFK's top-secret coup plan. And Bolden, you know, the civil rights pioneer, our first black American presidential Secret Service agent, was sent to prison for 6 years for trying to tell the truth and reveal the Tampa and Chicago attempts to the public. And he's been fighting for the last 40 years to try and clear his name. And just this past Tuesday, when I was allowed to provide some written material to that Shays Kucinich Committee, that's the first time Congress is hearing officially from us, that these secret plans to overthrow Castro existed. The code name was AM World, a term never in print in any congressional report, not until we put it in our book just a few months ago, and about Bolden and how he was framed, and he's still suffering because of that document destruction in 1995, those million documents still.
And we're trying to help him get his name cleared.
Well, that's true, and your listeners can help, too. I mean, if they want to see those million documents released, if they want to see this civil rights pioneer finally get the justice that he deserves, they should be contacting their congressperson, their senator, their elected officials, and let them know, I'm tired of this government secrecy. What's going on with the NSA spying and punishment of these other national security whistleblowers? See, that's why the government, some agencies, think they can get away with punishing these whistleblowers.
We're moving in the other direction, Lamar. Mike DeWine, the senator from Ohio, is apparently preparing to introduce legislation into the Senate that will make it a crime for anybody in the press to possess information about Bush administration crimes, even if they're not classified.
Well, and I can tell you this, Tom, some Bush administration people interpret the Espionage Act to prevent what you and I did.
I know.
In other words, that when you come across quite legally, even declassified information, if somebody, again, we've got the CIA now reclassifying information, how can you know what's legal to possess?
Are they going to come back and say that some of the stuff in our book, which we got declassified and is now being reclassified, is now classified and toss you and me in jail?
Well, the CIA did look at one of the files. You can actually track the audit history. And one of the files we actually have about the coup plan, and it gives the date of December 1st, 1963, just 10 days after the assassination. Somebody in the CIA actually pulled that file and apparently looked at it on microfilm actually right before the book was published.
Okay. Lamar Waldron, he's the author, along with Tom Hartman, of Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba, and the Murder of JFK.
Website,
Ultimate Sacrifice, the book, sunshineweek.org. Lamar, thanks so much for being with us.
Right.
It's 16
I
minutes past
all
the
your
hour.
Listeners to go to-
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Today you're working for the man. Well, pick up your feet. We got a deadline to meet. I'm gonna see you make it on time. Now, don't relax. I want elbows and backs. I want to see everybody come behind. 'Cause you're working for the man.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Services with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, I've been attending the White House press briefing. I attended the morning one as well today. And in both of those, the main subject was the National Security Strategy, which has been released today. Which reaffirms the doctrine of preemption when it comes to fighting wars.
I am convinced, Victoria, that these guys are going to spend the time from now until the November elections, from now until probably the second week of October, whipping up a war against Iran. And they're going to get all the usual suspects, all the, you know, the Hannitys and the Limbaughs and all the usual suspects out there going, yeah, yeah, Iran, big problem. Yeah, terrible problem. We got to do something. We got to do something. And within 3, 4, 5 weeks before the elections in November, there will be an attack on Iran.
Oh,
and, you know, whatever the fallout will be, there will be a rally around effect in the United States. Now, this is all assuming that there's not some kind of an attack against the United States between now and then. But Bush knows that the only way that he can hold on to the House and the Senate is with war. And if somebody doesn't bring it to us, he's going to create it someplace else.
Then I do think the question arises of whether he's actually fracturing right now, in the same way that I don't think that he's I don't think that the Democrats, for example, are factoring right about the dissension motion, because I don't think it will hurt them. I think he might be factoring wrong about that there's a point at which Americans are saying we actually don't want to go into Iran.
I agree with you. Dwight Eisenhower ran in 1952 on the platform of vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. And he won. I mean, he was the guy who said, yeah, well, see, Harry Truman's war in Korea was becoming very unpopular. And Eisenhower ran on the platform of, I will end the war in Korea. And he did. And basically the way he ended the war in Korea was by saying, okay, that's it. We're going to stop right here. End of, you know, we never took North Korea. The North Koreans won that part of North Korea. You know, it was like, you know, it would be very similar to if 10 years before we ended the Vietnam War, when we still had control of South Vietnam, we had said, okay, that's it. We stopped. Yeah, it's just South Vietnam and North Vietnam, and the communists can have their part, and we'll keep our part. And with Iraq, the equivalent of what Eisenhower did would be to say, okay, let's divide it up, or, you know, let's bring back Saddam or something. I mean, it's just actually, I don't think that there is a good equivalent.
I don't know that I'm on board with you there on bringing back Saddam.
Well, I don't think that Saddam himself would be a good thing, but frankly, it seems to me our efforts to put Chalabi in. I mean, here's a guy who's a convicted bank swindler, and I think that we were just going to replace one strong man with another.
Yeah, it will be very interesting to see if that is in fact what they do, because it is a huge gamble. I think both parties are taking huge gambles and possibly miscalculating. It's really going to be very interesting, and it could be as simple as, you know, you get a Paul Hackett to run. And it was a very funny Daily Show on him. I'm not sure if you saw it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Very funny. You get a Paul Hackett to run, and you let him go off and just do his thing, and people are tired of the war, and they'll vote for him. Sometimes things are as simple as that.
Well, that's the thing. I think that there's, unfortunately, there's not enough Democrats around who've ever read the history of the 1952 elections. You know, Eisenhower took down Truman.
Now, I mean, what do you know?
Yeah, I know. It's
now
incredible.
You want people to
now,
read.
The other thing I know is,
so demanding.
Yeah, sorry about that, Victoria. Well, you know, maybe they can get a History Channel DVD or something.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, there you go. So now I noticed that the Senate voted this morning to raise the debt ceiling up to just nearly $9 trillion. George W. Bush has borrowed and spent $3 trillion in 5 years. Now, my guess would be that if anybody was to borrow and spend $3 trillion in an economy the size of the U.S. economy, it would create some appearance of good economic times. And apparently he's been able to create that appearance, but I have a feeling a lot of people, it's like that old science fiction story where, you know, they finally made it to the moon and discovered that it was 2x4s with canvas stretched over the top of it, you know, that it was hollow inside. That a lot of Americans are going, oh, wait a minute, our economy isn't quite what we thought it was.
I know. I kind of feel like, you know, if I've spent $9 trillion, I want to have had a really good time.
There you go. Well,
you know,
I think the Bushes did.
I want to feel embarrassed about how good a time I had.
Did you see that inaugural ball that he had? I mean, you know, the Bushes are having a good time. They're flying around in corporate jets. They're flying around on, you know, Air Force One. You know, $50,000 an hour to fly down to Crawford, Texas, because he forgot to submit his absentee ballot, and, you know, gets no flack from the press for it. But anyhow, the point is that debt was raised without one single Democratic vote. And two Republicans defected. Are the Republicans going to take a hit on this?
Oh, which? That's very interesting. I'd love to know which Republicans defected.
The two that defected were what's his name in Nevada, the guy who shares Nevada with Harry Reid.
Oh yeah.
And Conrad Burns in Montana.
Had we not
Ensign in Nevada,
who's got a very difficult election coming up? We not mounted Operation Swarmer today, I think that the Republicans would have been held to account for this. But I think that the Iraq news is so huge and the national security is so huge that I think that the debt story, it'll get coverage on the nightly news, but it's by and large going to be lost.
Very quickly, Victoria Jones, do you think that they timed this massive bombing campaign in Iraq to get the debt news off the headlines?
Well, McClellan was asked about that, not so much the debt, but about other issues. He says it had nothing to do with Bush. It was the generals on the ground.
Yeah, and if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks so much for being with us, Victoria. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Exposing the con in conservative. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Sometimes you think you've got it all figured out. You know what's going on. You know what you know. You know what you don't know. And then sometimes you discover.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be the Pentagon's defense scientists want to create an army of cyber insects that can be remotely controlled, writes Gary Kitchener in BBC News. I'm quite serious. DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Pentagon, a $2 billion budget, large agency, has put out a bid. They want to insert microsystems at the pupa stage so when insects can integrate them into their body so they can be remotely controlled later. A similar scheme aimed at manipulating wasps failed when they flew off to feed and mate. Imagine if they tried this on people. Right. Okay, let's introduce these microchips into fetuses, and then when they grow up, they'll have it built into their brain. Their brain will grow around it, and then we'll be able to control them until an attractive member of the opposite sex walks by. That's what happened with the wasps. As soon as the wasps got horny, that was it. They were out of there. Anyhow, the winning bidder will have to deliver an insect within 5 meters of a specific target located 100 meters away. The insect's cyborg must also be able to transmit data from relevant sensors, yielding information about the local environment. These sensors can include gas sensors, microphones, video, etc. Now, these people are not totally crazy. They've done things before, some of which worked, some of which didn't work. For example, the ones that didn't work that we know of. In World War II, they were going to try to attach a bomb to a cat and drop it from a dive bomber onto a Nazi ship. The cat, hating water, will wrangle itself up on the enemy's ship's deck and then explode. In the tests, however, the cats became unconscious in midair, so that didn't work. In World War II, they also tried attaching incendiaries to bats, inducing hibernation, and then dropping them from planes. The problem is the bats didn't wake up in time until it hit the ground, and that was the end of that one. But in the Vietnam War, they were actually successful. They trained dolphins to tear diving gear off of Viet Cong divers and drag them to interrogation. That worked. And later, syringes were placed on dolphin flippers to inject carbon dioxide into divers who would then explode. 40 divers are thought to have been killed by these killer dolphins that the U.S. Army trained during the Vietnam War. So, you never know. Anything is possible, I guess. Anything is possible. It's even possible that we could have clean elections here in the United States. It's possible. It's possible. Someday, it's possible that the Democrats could win. It's possible. You know, got to speak up. But Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon, welcome to the program.
Hi, was that me?
That's you.
Oh, hi. This is actually more of a thank you than a comment.
Okay.
It's very easy to be totally disheartened these days. And I thank you for all your education that you do on the air. But the biggest thing is I borrowed something from you, and I'm trying really hard to incorporate it because it's, I don't know how you keep the attitude, but I just love it when people call you up and ask you how you are, and you say, I'm great, but I'll be better.
Well, I stole that line.
I'm trying to incorporate that into my life, and I don't know how you do it.
I stole that line from my dear old friend Don Hoy, who turned 80 last week, and he lives in Michigan. I called him up, and he's been saying that as long as I've been around. I've known Don for at least 30 years, maybe longer. And it's, I mean, what are the options?
I know, and I said it to somebody at work, and my workplace isn't that much fun, and the look of total surprise on their face was worth it.
Well, it's we are either going down or we're going up. I mean, it's that way with the economy. It's that way with democracy. It's that way with us individually. I mean, yes, entropy is going to get all of us eventually. I mean, you know, we're eventually all going to get old and die. And, you know, I'm frankly, I consider that the next step in a great adventure. But you know, everybody has their own take on that as well. But nonetheless, I think that it's just there is no percentage in despair. There just is none. And the ability of people to translate righteous anger and upset and information that provokes an emotional response into positive action has historically, I mean, look back all the way to the founding of this country, has always historically been what has saved this country.
So
I think, frankly, it saves us individually.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Sharon, thank you very much for the call. Very kind of you. Frank in Roseville, California. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hey, you know about the cats, that they could use those cats over and over again since they have nine lives.
Yeah, in theory.
I have two questions for you.
Oh, by the way, speaking of nine lives, did you know that Russ Feingold's middle name starts with a D? I think it's like Dor or Dus or Duff, something like that. And so if you take the initials of his name, and you reverse them, it becomes FDR.
Oh, wow. That is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So it would be interesting to know if he was born after Roosevelt died, and maybe reincarnation is possible. Who
That's
knows?
Possible.
Anyhow,
know.
Frank, you were going in another direction.
I had two questions. Sure. One is, can you explain why it's bad for U.S. business to have Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq change from dollars to euros? I don't understand that.
Sure, yeah. In other words, why should America be so hysterical about the Iranians or the Iraqis?
You say that all the time, and I don't understand why.
Okay.
And the second question is, do you think that today's attack on in Iraq, by the way, major combat operations are over, but do you think today's attack is the opening of the Republican 2006 election campaign?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Absolutely, Frank. They realize that this thing is slipping away from them, and they've got to do something. And tragically, this is what they're doing. I mean, you know, they don't understand the situation clearly, and I guarantee you that innocent civilians have died, and all of those civilians have friends and relatives, and they are, you know, this is the kind of stuff that just feeds an insurgency. It just makes it worse. It's by the way, Russ Feingold's middle name is Dana. Russ Dana Feingold, RDF. So that's FDR backwards. With regard to the euro and the dollars, see, tell me if this makes sense, Frank. The United States is buying more stuff from the rest of the world than it's selling to the rest of the world. The only way that we can sustain that, number one, actually there's two deficits. There's that's our trade deficit. And then there's also our internal budget deficit. That's the one that just got raised today, our debt. The debt is the consequence of years and years of deficits. It's the accumulated. So this year's deficit might be $600 billion or $300 billion, whatever it is. This year's deficit just gets added to that debt. So you with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to borrow from the rest of the world roughly $300-400 billion a year to keep our government running, or at least we have had to ever since Bush took office. Clinton actually had a balanced budget and a surplus budget where we didn't have to borrow any money from anybody. But under Bush, once he started the tax cuts, we have to borrow money to keep our government going, number one. And number two, we have to cause the rest of the world to want to hold our currency and buy America, essentially, buy things either that we make or simply buy our land, our businesses, our ports, whatever, in order to pay in exchange for all the stuff that we want to import. By and large, it falls into two broad categories. Number one is energy, mostly oil that we import into the United States, constitutes maybe a third of the imports. And the second broad category is finished goods, consumer goods that we're importing. We used to manufacture in the United States. We no longer manufacture in the United States. So in order to get countries to be willing to buy our country, we've got to get them to want to take dollars or to buy goods from us. And in order to get countries to want to buy our treasuries, our instruments of debt, in other words, loan us money, we have to get them to want to take dollars. And in other words, we've got to make dollars the default currency of the world. The only way that a currency can be the default currency of the world is if it's the currency that's convertible into the most common medium of exchange in the world. Now, back 100 years ago, that was gold.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the U.S. was on the gold standard,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we had to have our currency be convertible into the primary default instrument of exchange. Well, today, I mean, you know, there are a lot of people calling for a return to the gold standard and all that. But basically, when Nixon took us off the gold standard in, as I recall, 72, we shifted from being a gold standard currency to being an oil standard currency. Combining the fact that the United States was one of the larger producers of oil in the world, or at least was up through the 80s, and we actually export a lot of oil, oddly enough. A lot of our oil from Alaska is going to Japan, and the Anwar oil is scheduled to go to Japan, most of it. So by denominating oil all around the world in dollars, by convincing the rest of the world that they should trade oil in dollars, what we were able to do was create an environment where other countries want to hold dollars so that they can buy oil, or so that they can buy pretty much anything else, because oil becomes, you know, it's like the secondary, it's like the fallback currency or commodity. And if oil starts trading in euros instead of dollars, and that spreads, I mean, if it just happens in Iran, probably not a big deal. If it just happened in Iraq, probably not a big deal. But if Saudi Arabia starts doing it, if Venezuela starts doing it, if Mexico starts doing it, if Canada starts doing it, the really large oil exporting countries, if Russia starts doing it, if they start denominating oil in euros, then a lot of countries in the world are going to look around and they're going to say, what are we doing with all these dollars? We don't need these dollars. And they're going to dump those dollars and convert them into euros. When they dump those dollars, the world is going to be awash in dollars. We've been running our printing presses like crazy. There's trillions and trillions of dollars outside the United States that we really can't reabsorb. And if the rest of the world was to suddenly start shedding dollars, start dumping dollars, what would happen is that the value of the dollar would collapse, and we would have a hyperinflation here in the United States, just like Germany did in the early 1920s, when in order to repay the Treaty of Versailles, they ran their printing presses all the time and printed Deutschmarks like crazy, to the point where it literally took as much as a billion Deutschmarks to buy dinner. And you could see that kind of thing happen in the United States very easily. 45 minutes past the hour. Thanks for calling and asking the question.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, yeah.
I know a place. Ain't nobody crying.
Welcome to the vast liberal conspiracy. Take no invitations, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Just to clarify, just a follow-up on that last call. If you look at a dollar bill, you'll see across the top, it just says Federal Reserve Note. Basically, the bottom line is that a dollar bill only has value internationally. It only has value to the extent that it can be converted into something. Used to be that you could convert it into gold. Then in the 70s, we decided to say you can convert it into oil. And we essentially traded gold for oil. Now, if the rest of the world decides, okay, we're not going to trade dollars for oil anymore, we're going to make euros the currency that oil is traded in, then you can no longer convert a dollar into oil, and you can no longer convert it into gold. What can you convert it into? Well, it'll depend. In other words, the currency will just completely float. It'll be essentially untethered. You could argue that the fact that gold has doubled in price since Bush became president and oil has doubled in price, more than doubled in price, means that the value of the dollar has already dropped in half. And, in fact, I think you'd make a successful argument on that. But anyhow, that's the whole point, is that if we go off the oil standard, then there is no standard against which the dollar can be measured, and that could mean the collapse of the dollar, much like the Mexican peso, much like the currency in Argentina. I was down in Argentina, 4 years ago or so, right after their currency crashed as a result of IMF interventions or trying to get, you know, in with the IMF. This is not a new story. Other countries have been through this before. Jeff, for going down the same road we've gone down, which is irresponsible spending. Jeff in South Hero, Vermont, and debt. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm great. What's up, Jeff?
Listen, I called you a few days ago. I talked to you about Congressman Sanders and people of Vermont wanting the congressman to back impeachment stuff.
Right, and he has signed on to Conyers' bill. Yeah, it was last Thursday, actually.
Yeah, and I hadn't heard about it here on the radio, and I just wanted to pass the news on.
Yeah, it's great news, isn't it, Jeff?
Fantastic news.
I think, I agree with Bernie that it's largely symbolic. You know,
I think it's totally symbolic,
yeah,
but I think it's important.
Exactly. Symbols count.
And, can I say this, too?
Sure.
People should call their senators, I've already done it, and tell their senators, because these things count, to back Russ Feingold.
Amen.
On the censure thing.
Yep. And the toll-free number to call your senator is, or your congressman, a member of Congress, if you want to tell your member of Congress to back John Conyers and his impeachment resolution, which is H.R. 635. The toll-free number is 888-355-3588.
All right,
Jeff, thanks a lot.
Tom.
Great to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Shane in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Shane, what's on your mind today?
I was just watching CNN, and they just had to evacuate the Cox building at UCLA because of a suspicious package found. After I wake up and hear about all the big bombing and everything that they had to do in Iraq today, I'm so fed up because this man plays so dumb about everything. Oh, I had no idea that all these black people were drowning in the Ninth Ward. I had no idea everybody in my administration, is crooked. I didn't know this was happening. Oh, the ports, this deal, I had no idea. I want to know, Tom, when is Kaiser Soze going to walk down the street and straighten out his foot so that we can all see that he's been the mastermind the whole time.
Yeah.
I saw the usual suspects. You saw the usual suspects. When is Kaiser going to let us see?
Kaiser?
You know what I'm saying?
Kaiser, I don't understand.
Kaiser, so the usual suspects, where they have them all in the same room.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Referring
to the dumb guy that nobody least expects it, that's got the limp foot walking at the end. You finally see that it was the idiot box that was running the whole game the whole time.
Well,
I don't know.
I think what's happening, Shane, is that Americans are starting to wake up, and they are saying, I remember when Tom Ridge, who was the head of the Homeland Security Department, after he left, he did the TV talk circuit, and he was on all these TV talk shows, and this was after the 2004 elections, early 2005, and he was saying, they would say, well, why did you run up those terror alerts every time John Kerry started getting some traction in the polls? And he was like, well, that wasn't my idea. I was opposed to those. Those were coming out of the White House. Karl Rove was using terror as a political tool against the American people.
Yes,
and he continues to. And Tom Ridge is the guy who told us about it. So I think if Americans and the press have not figured this out, we've got a big problem and we need to keep telling them. Shane, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. I appreciate it, though. Great to hear from you. Steve in Springfield, Mass. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing? This question, I was glad the fellow a couple of calls back called and asked you to explain somewhat the euro thing. Because, my speculation is, I don't know, it comes out of a lot of naivete, and I need you to maybe explain some stuff that you can. But one thing I want you to know is after you used the German analogy, the interbellum German analogy, and after the Treaty of Versailles, did Germany maintain a well-trained standing army from 18 to 33? 1918 to 1933. I mean, did they have a high level of comparative readiness?
I don't know. Honestly don't know, Steve. I'm not that much of a scholar at that time. I do know that one of the things that Hitler did that dramatically helped turn around the German economy and help stabilize the Deutschmark was massive military spending.
And that's sort of the line I sort of was going down. I just sort of see. The American, the relatively very well-trained, high-readiness American military as having become and will be the essence of the full faith and credit of the United States government.
I think you're absolutely right, Steve. I think you're absolutely right. And it's a good point that you make, and I appreciate your calling and making it. We're out of time, however, but it's a good point. We'll get into that more in detail as time goes on. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the true people's radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, but every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, friends, to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. Speaking of smart people, Dr. Peter Tonz is with us. He's with the Global Monitoring Division of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Since 1985, he's led the Carbon Cycle Greenhouse Gases Group at the Global Monitoring Division of NOAA's Earth System Research Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado. This is the leading international program measuring carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases and forms the backbone of the Global Atmosphere Watch Program of the World Meteorological Organization. Dr. Tonz, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be there.
Very glad to have you here with us. Dr. Tonz, we have been reading in the papers here recently that carbon dioxide has been spiking more rapidly than we have seen in the past. We've passed several new critical thresholds. What does this mean?
I should start by saying that even though I work for NOAA, I'm not speaking for NOAA. I'm speaking for myself.
Right.
As a scientist.
All right.
Okay, having said that, the increase that we saw this last year, 2005, of carbon dioxide was one of the highest we've ever observed. So in that sense, it's somewhat special. But in another sense, it's not special because the modern measurements of carbon dioxide directly done in the atmosphere started in 1958. That was done by David Keeling of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And so we're now in our 48th year of that. Every single year, carbon dioxide has gone up. What we do see today is that, say, the five-year average rate of CO2 increase is about three times as high as it was when these measurements were started in the late 50s and early 60s.
What does this mean?
And it's because we know for a fact that this increase is caused by the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. And the rate of burning today is slightly over 7 billion tons of carbon per year. That is somewhat, you could say that's equivalent to 7 cubic kilometers of stuff, whereas in the late 50s, early 60s, it was approximately 2 billion tons of carbon. So the rate of burning has gone up significantly, as has the rate of atmospheric CO2 increase.
Now, as the atmospheric CO2 goes up, we're also seeing an increase in other greenhouse gases, methane, for example. Some people are suggesting this is a consequence of global warming, thawing out old peat bogs and other sources of methane. Others point to industrial agriculture. What's your take on this?
Yeah, methane is quite an effective greenhouse gas per molecule, but there's much less of it in the atmosphere.
Right.
Now, methane has been going up also since pre-industrial times, since, say, 1850, by a factor of about 2.5. So that's quite a significant increase.
Mm-hmm.
We think that this is mostly due to things like rice agriculture, animal husbandry, like cows emit methane, for example. Right. Wetlands have decreased, actually, in a lot of tropical areas, which might have methane emissions somewhat. It also comes from fossil fuel exploration and exploitation. When we pump up oil, for example, the gas that is often associated with these oil reservoirs, it used to be just flared into the atmosphere and lost. Now we capture it. So it used to be a relatively large source, not so much anymore. When we mine coal, for example, methane is liberated.
What about the thawing of the tundra, the permafrost in Siberia,
I know that
Alaska?
There is a possibility that as the tundra warms, that we create initially more wetlands and eventually it will thaw out. if we create more wetlands, we may actually cause higher methane emissions.
Now we just.
But I must say, we have a global observing network of these things. Mm-hmm. We don't see that. So we don't see that the rate that methane at high northern latitudes is rising faster than elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for the last 10 years, methane has stayed almost constant in the atmosphere. That's not true for CO2. CO2
right.
continues to go up.
Okay. Well, we only have about 5 minutes to wrap this up, and I want to get to kind of, you know, the punchline. I mean, what does this mean to all of us? We just saw Hurricane Katrina. We just saw the worst tornadoes in American history, at least for some of the regions that they hit. Weather is getting wilder, it seems. It's getting more unpredictable. Is this a consequence of this increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, or could it be?
I would say it's likely. You know, we cannot prove this without any reasonable doubt. What we can say is that the increased greenhouse gases, and CO2 in particular, do change the heat balance of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And currently, CO2 alone has changed that by 0.7% of all solar absorbed radiation. The climate is driven by the absorption of solar radiation, more in the tropics and relatively little at high latitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And that temperature difference generates winds and ocean currents, basically generates the climate that redistributes the excess heat from the tropics, redistributes it partially to higher latitudes. That is the climate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we put these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we prevent some of the heat radiation that escapes normally from the Earth into space, that prevents it heating up the lower part of the atmosphere more than it otherwise would.
Right.
So we're changing the climate engine of the Earth. That's something we know. There's no doubt about it. And we even know by how much.
So what will the consequence of that be for us humans?
That's actually quite difficult to predict what will happen exactly. So we're intensifying the climate engine, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But to make really credible predictions at this point about it will get wetter here, warmer there, a little bit cooler there,
right.
Hurricanes will become more intense. These things are all likely.
Well, here's a couple.
We cannot really prove it at this point.
Right. A couple of quick questions then.
Yeah.
So far, you know, up until this point, the atmosphere has been in relative equilibrium. It's been fairly stable for about 11,000 years, I believe, and relatively speaking. And there is some concern that we could flip into a positive feedback loop where every change in the atmosphere that would normally trigger a corresponding negative change will instead trigger a corresponding positive change and create a spiral, an amplification spiral. For example, the carbon hydrates that are frozen below the surface of the sea could begin to melt, and you know, you'd have soda pop, you know, like opening a bottle of Coca-Cola. All of a sudden, the sea starts bubbling all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and methane because there's millions, billions of tons of that stuff under there. That's number one, and number two, shutting down the Gulf Stream, which brings heat to Europe. At least to the western part of Europe.
Yes.
And you know, if that were to happen, then Western Europe is going to end up with a climate very much like Siberia. Are those things in the cards?
I would say they're in the realm of plausible. But
not just possible, but plausible.
Yeah, I'd say the Gulf Stream will likely be affected by all this.
In our lifetime?
It may not be as we expect currently, as climate models have their, you know, different climate models predict this slightly differently, each one of them. And it may still be that we've overlooked something for our prediction. So I do expect the Gulf Stream to change, but not necessarily precisely as it's predicted.
Sure.
Similarly, for these methane hydrates that you mentioned, that is potentially a trigger to huge climate change.
This would be like end of dinosaurs kind of climate change.
Yeah, that
we're
kind
talking
of climate
about
change.
You know, during the last extinction, we saw something like 90% of life on Earth vanish. I mean, it was just a massive extinction.
And I tell you, something like this happened actually 55 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A huge addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere ocean system happened at that time, and it was a very sudden spike. and it increased global temperatures by between 5 and 10 degrees centigrade.
Dr. Tan, we have less than 30 seconds left.
Yeah,
have we reached a point of no return?
I can't say that. I can say that we already have committed the Earth to significantly more warming than what we have already seen by the CO2 that has already been emitted. That's a fact. Because the Earth has not come to equilibrium with the CO2 that has already been emitted. So that's still to come. Then we are furthermore committed to additionally a very large additional amount of carbon dioxide emissions just because our industrial society depends on emitting CO2, on burning coal, etc., and therefore emitting CO2 on basically giving us the energy that we need to function. This we cannot change in a couple decades. It takes a long time to reform our energy system. So
sobering news. Dr. Peter Tans with the Global Monitoring Division of NOAA, speaking for himself. Dr. Tans, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thanks.
And for more information, www.cmdl.noaa.gov, the website. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Democracy Now!
You know, this song, it's interesting. It really, really exposes the iron fist behind the velvet glove of the myth of the great melting pot. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We have been saying for a couple of centuries to people of different religions, of different races, of different cultures, of different countries, but mostly different cultures. Very often you find religion or race associated with culture. We've been saying to people of different cultures, you're welcome to come to America. You're welcome to come to our country. You can become just like us. And the implicit message is that we're the superior culture. Your culture isn't worth the hill of beans. And there's a lot of, and this is, I think, a good chunk of why the Bush administration is so blind in their policies towards Iraq. It's why they're just so absolutely blind when it comes to Iraq. It's because they really believe this stuff. They really, the trashing the Iraqi culture. I got a clip here of Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly goes on about how he doesn't do personal attacks, but somewhere embedded in this clip is his take on Iraqi culture. Just you get a sense of this is the ugly American.
This is not Madison, Wisconsin, where we expect those people to be communing with Satan up there. And I don't have any respect, by and large, for the Iraqi people at all. I have no respect for them. I think that they're a prehistoric group. If Joseph Stalin was still alive, he'd be the UNICEF spokesperson.
Yeah, so, and he goes on and on. It's, just this weird sickness of Bill O'Reilly. But the point is that we have been saying for a long, long time, our culture is the only culture that's any good. Everybody should be just like us. The Iraqis should be just like us. The Russians should be just like us. The Chinese should be just like us. We're going to redo the Human Rights Commission on the UN. Everybody's got to be just like us. They have to conform to our standards of human rights. And there are people, I have a friend who used to live in East Germany, and when it was East Germany, and I visited East Germany when it was East Germany, and I thought it was a very grim place, right? Looking around at it from my point of view, the Western point of view, I'm looking around and I'm saying, this is a dictatorship. People don't have freedom. My oldest daughter and I made the trip over there one day. It was just a day trip. Louise took the other kids to the first time I went there. And it was a rainy day, a cold, gray, rainy day in the late spring in Germany. And everything was gray. Everything was gray. I mean, after we paid our 50 Deutsche Marks, right, to get through the border. And we stood at a taxi stand with a bunch of people for a long, long time. No taxi ever came. Finally, this kid comes by in his car. His name was Toastin. I remember that. Like Toaster, Toastin. Came by, and we had to make up this whole story about how we were his cousins from America, and we hadn't seen him, and we were related, and he was related in my father's family, three generations. You know, the whole thing, in case the police stopped us, because it was illegal for him to be running a private taxi illegally. And I'm thinking, this is a tyranny. This is terrible. And, you know, I have a friend who, I'm not going to name him, he's a fairly well-known musician now, internationally, who grew up in East Germany, and he has told me, you know, it was actually pretty good. You had health care, you didn't have to worry about that. You had retirement, you didn't have to worry about that. You had a job, you had all the education you wanted, everything was free. I mean, you had to work. Now, I'm not here to pitch the wonders of communism. I still, from my point of view, it was miserable. I wouldn't want to live there. But I can tell you from having lived in Germany for a year after reunification, that there are still people in Germany who are saying, hey, wait a minute. There are a lot of people in Russia going, you know, we never had homeless people before. And again, this is not, I'm not singing the song of communism. What I'm saying is that different cultures around the world, different people around the world have chosen to live their own ways. And for us Americans to go around and say, no, you've got to be just like us, is so incredibly culturist. And that is the unique sickness in some ways that drives things like this, preemptive attack strategy, this new report out, the new defense strategy of the United States. This idea, you know, we've got it all figured out. Everything goes by the standards of America. You know, John Bolton, we and three little nations that nobody has ever heard of or visited voted not to push forward the new Human Rights Commission in the United Nations because it just wasn't to our standards, according to John Bolton. Now, frankly, I have to say that John Bolton's standards are not my standards. But anyhow, the point being that this transcends racism and sexism and all and nationalism, even this culturalism, and you know, so off on a rant, something to think about. Your food for thought for the day. We'll talk about it later. We'll be back with your phone calls and more. I've got a behind enemy lines alert and more news right after this. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I ain't looking to compete with you. Beat or cheat or mistreat you. Simplify you, pacify you. Deny, defy, or crucify you. All I really want to do is maybe be friends with you.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, the place where being progressive never felt so good. The True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Jason McElwain, a.k.a. J-Mac, the autistic high school basketball player, as they note over on thinkprogress.org, gained national attention when he scored 20 points for his varsity team with a flurry of three-pointers. While President Bush has publicly acknowledged his admiration for the young star, maybe you saw this on TV, this clip of George W. Bush, and it was so moving. It was really sweet, actually. This kid just so impressed that the president would, you know, give him a hug and say hi to him and acknowledge him. I mean, you can just imagine that this kid, this was like the high point of his life, this autistic kid. Unfortunately, the reporters, I saw it on CNN, the reporters did not point out that in Bush's proposed budget for next year, he has cut all funding for a program called the National Children's Study. This is a project that planned to investigate the causes of autism, along with asthma and other serious illnesses. So here's an autistic kid. Oh, we don't want to find out what caused that. We've got to have tax cuts for billionaires and millionaires. The president's budget will eliminate Medicaid reimbursements for school children with disabilities, including kids with autism, denying them access to medical services they need to fully participate in school and learn to their greatest abilities. And while the number of children diagnosed with autism and served by schools under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, increased by more than 500% in the last 10 years, according to the GAO, the president's fiscal year 07 budget will fund IDEA $6.3 billion below the amount that Congress recommended. It's a tragedy. It's just amazing. And what's the real tragedy, I guess, is that the media did not point this out, that you had to learn about it here instead of on CNN when you saw Bush hugging this kid. When are they going to start putting two and two together? I got some incredible results, by the way, here from the American Research Group. We'll get to that in just a second. First, Dick in Seattle on the line. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today? Dick in Seattle? There's no Dick there. Let's try Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. When you're speaking a few minutes ago about, you know, America's view of the rest of the world, I think it's important for us to look at what people actually think. I've been to several dozen countries. And it was interesting, in the mid-'80s, I was in Fiji. And I was there with a Fijian, and we were just talking for a while, and I asked him how much money he made. I said, oh, that's a shame. You know, it seems so little. And talked about what he wanted. He said, no, I don't need any more money. I'd get lazy. And I noticed going around the world after that people didn't necessarily want to be like Americans. They didn't want what we had.
Right.
Of all the countries I've been to, there's only one where people consistently wanted to come to the U.S. That was a long time ago. That was Morocco.
Hmm.
But otherwise, some people say, oh, I'd like to visit. But, yeah, no, we're fine here.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, the U.S., the people think that people are friendly here, but they think the government just sucks. And when I was just overseas in Europe, I found consistently it was really strange. Well, one is, like, in some countries I found the people there knew more about America than Americans know about America.
Yes.
It was embarrassing. Like, you know, you just say Thomas Jefferson, and they say, oh, that was your third president, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And I've asked friends since they came back here. They didn't know what number president he was or things like that.
Right. Or even that he was president, necessarily.
Yeah. And then consistently right now, what they say is, first of all, they ask about Dick Cheney.
Mm.
And then they say...
You've recently been overseas, Jeff?
Yeah. I was just over in Europe and also in Costa Rica the past year. But people are consistently ask about Dick Cheney first, that think he's in control.
Yeah.
They also say, how could you have let 2004 happen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, November, they're just shocked.
Then you mean the theft of the vote in Ohio?
Yeah, all around. They just said, we just couldn't believe that he got in again.
Yeah.
And then they ask about Kyoto. With the exception of, not a single person I've talked to any place around the world does not support Kyoto, even the few that support Bush.
Yeah.
They ask, how could you not support Kyoto? And they're just, you know, totally shocked. And then they're also shocked that we haven't seen the Abu Ghraib and other torture videos.
Right.
Most people I know in Europe have seen the videos. I said, the Americans haven't seen the videos?
Right.
Yeah, they're shocked. I mean, they know more about us.
Yeah, the videos are very, very gruesome.
Yeah. And why is our news media not showing those when... European media showing it.
Well, they say that they're not showing them because they're gruesome, but that's nonsense. I mean, they could delete, parse, and, you know, they could, yeah.
They could also give us a choice. I thought we had freedom here.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the points. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, I was saying Toastin, you know, picked us up in the taxi, and we had to come up with this whole story because it was illegal to be a taxi driver. Well, it's illegal in the United States to be a taxi driver, I guess, if you fly into New Jersey or into LaGuardia and there's the illegal taxi drivers lined up there. But it's really qualitatively different. I mean, you can become one. By the way, David Poole, our producer here, tells me that the videos, the torture videos, are on Salon.com if people want to see them.
Yeah.
Jeff, thanks for the call. I got to move along. Good to hear from you. Let's try Dick in Seattle one more time. Hey, Dick.
Yeah, Tom. Yeah, I got to take a little bit of exception to your JFK mob did it theory, because I think it tends to let the real culprits, the CIA, off the hook. And you know, I wanted to offer an alternative perspective on the CIA and their relationship with the mob in the 60s, and why they're so opposed to releasing 40-year-old classified documents, including even now reclassifying those already released. because I think the first thing you have to realize is that the CIA's main mission has always been representing the overseas investment interest of our big money establishment. I mean, they are and work for the establishment, and that was a target of the Kennedy administration. And, you know, second consideration here is up until a year ago, they would often operate as an independent rogue agency. I mean, essentially, they were following all too often their own orders and running their own agenda. And that's how they wound up, I think, hiring the mob for assassinations while their attorney general was so busy prosecuting them.
Actually, it was Nixon's idea when he was vice president under Eisenhower.
Pardon me?
It was Nixon's idea when he was vice president under Eisenhower. He was put in charge of what was called the Cuba Working Group.
Yeah, and he came up with the Bay of Pigs invasion with E. Howard Hunt as well.
That's right. It was to be an October surprise to blow out Jack Kennedy in the election of 1960. And but Dick, I appreciate the call, and you made your point, and I'm not going to argue with you on it. I try to stay away from the Kennedy assassination stuff on the program unless we're doing an entire program on it, because as soon as we start talking about it. It's like trying to push away flypaper. You know, it becomes the entire show, and we've only got 15 minutes left here. Brian in Eureka, California. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Just a couple quick points going along your lines of your show today. First off, in raising the debt ceiling and stuff like that, I always found it comical when one faction would say, "Oh my God, tax and spend, tax and spend." Well, you know, I think that's better than borrowing and spending and borrowing and spending, minus the studies on why kids fall off tricycles. I think that's kind of ridiculous. But,
yep.
You know, the other thing is, as far as incompetency goes, there's a real kind of interesting take on that. On the surface, that seems absolutely so. How incompetent, Katrina, the war, the this, the that. But a Bay Area program, Progressive Radio, a guy called in and said, "Hey, I'm going to call you on this." And incompetent? Look at the facts. They've gotten almost everything they've wanted. Pack the Supreme Court, tax breaks for the rich. I mean, you almost got to kind of wonder if it's not kind of a red herring. Yeah, we're a bunch of incompetent fools, but behind
I think it absolutely is, Brian. I think that this is their argument, as it were. This is their excuse. Oh, we're incompetent. They would much rather be incompetent than being criminally negligent or criminal, period.
Exactly.
And yeah, absolutely. I'm right there with you. Brian, thanks a lot for the
call.
Go back to your calls in just a minute. First, I have to tell you about this. The first survey done, this was done by the American Research Group. You can find it at AmericanResearchGroup.com. The first national poll done about whether or not Americans support Russ Feingold and John Conyers' attempts to, in the case of Feingold in the Senate, censure the president, which is not censor, it's censure. And in the House of which means basically slap his hand rather than put a gag over his mouth. And in the House of Representatives, whether people support John Conyers, House Resolution 635, which actually doesn't call for the impeachment of President George W. Bush. It simply calls for an investigation to determine whether there may be impeachable offenses. And so here are the questions. Do you favor or oppose the United States Senate passing a resolution censuring President George W. Bush for authorizing wiretaps of Americans within the United States without obtaining court orders? All adults, 46% favor, 44% oppose, 10% undecided. So the majority of American adults favor censuring the president on this. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. If you look at Democrats, 70% of Democrats favor censuring the president. 25% are opposed to it, 26%, excuse me, and 4% undecided. So if any Democrat wants an issue to run with in a primary or in an election, and they want to bring the Democratic voters to the polls, any senator, they should be signing on with Feingold right now. With regard to Republicans, this is mind-boggling. 29% of Republicans, that's almost a third of all the Republicans they asked, do you think that Bush should be censured for wiretapping Americans without court orders, said yes. Almost a third of the Republicans. 42% of the independents. With regard to the House of Representatives, should Bush be impeached? All adults, 42%, yes. Republicans, 18%. Democrats, 61% to 30%. Independents, 47%, yes, to 40% opposed. These are winning symbolic issues, at least symbolic until the Republicans are out of control, my friends. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed! Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the Smart People's Radio Program. 9 minutes before the hour. Oh, my. John Bolt, they're ginning this thing up. They are getting ready. They're cranking it up as fast, as far, as hard, as fast as they can. It has already begun. John Bolton compares Iran threat to 9/11. The American ambassador to the United Nations has compared the threat from Iran's nuclear programs to the 9/11 attacks in the United States. This from Al Jazeera. .net. Just like September 11, said John Bolton. He told ABC News' Nightline program on Wednesday, just like September 11, only with nuclear weapons this time. That's the threat. I think that is the threat. It is, I'm telling you, it is, these guys, it is coming. They are cranking it up. Front page of the Wall Street Journal today, new White House national security strategy identifies Iran as the single country that may pose the biggest danger to the U.S. and reaffirms preemptive military action as a central tenet of U.S. security policy. Listen, last time I looked, the only country in the last 10 years to have threatened us with a nuclear weapon was China. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, how are you doing today?
It's fine. It's time for a reality check.
Yes, sir.
In my opinion, the American people are witnessing, economically and politically, what you get when the PNAC, Carlisle, Bush crime family are running the whorehouse of Congress together with a carnival-type funhouse of mirrors, distorting and prostituted Illuminati media.
Okay. Now, all of that said, Armin, what are you going to do about it?
Well, when they yell Iran, let's just all cheer louder, Contra, when they yell Iran.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Contra.
I like that.
Contra. Iran Contra.
Yeah, we sold them those missiles. Those are our missiles. We want them back. Maybe
Contra.
We don't.
Contra.
Maybe we don't.
Contra. Contra.
Okay, good one, Ron. Good on you. Good on you, Armin. I appreciate it. And maybe we don't want those missiles back. You know, maybe we just as soon, since Reagan sold them those missiles in exchange for their holding the hostages while Jimmy Carter's candidacy was melting down in 1979, or 1980, rather, the election in 1980, maybe we'd rather they just hung on to them. Evelyn in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Evelyn, what's on your mind today?
Commenting on a previous comment about an hour ago regarding guards in employment situations.
Yeah.
3 years ago in Seattle, there was a billboard by the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. It was co-sponsored by the Ad Council, and it had a woman who was in regular office attire and another one in armor. It said, "Wears body armor, manages an office thanks to her employer's support." And later I saw in the local post office something on their bulletin board about the same institution or branch of the organization called the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. I don't know much more about it, but it seems like they were soliciting employers to get their employees to join the Guard.
Right. It's sort of like the propaganda or PR or whatever you want to call it that this government was engaged in during World War II to get people to... Well, we had a draft ultimately, but
right.
You get people into the military. During Vietnam, it didn't work quite so well. They just simply had to do a draft. But you know,
I also wanted to comment on one of the people questioned where to get information on the electronic voting.
Yeah.
There's several websites. You probably have heard of them. There's one called, they're all www's. It's
sure.
blackboxvoting.org.
Yeah, Bev Harris, she's been on this program
right.
many times.
There's
yeah.
votersunite.org.
Mm-hmm.
And VoteTrustUSA.org, and all those are run together.
Yeah.
And also, if anybody wants to find out about specific candidates
mm-hmm.
and current legislators and congresspeople, there's another website called ProjectVoteSmart.org, and it's vote-smart.org.
Okay, great. Evelyn, thank you very much.
You're
great
welcome.
To hear from you. Brian in Everett. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
I find some humor in the Bush relating to the autistic basketball player.
Yeah.
In a sense that it's like you assume that someone who's autistic is clueless about a certain layer of sociality around them, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's almost, in a non-pejorative way, it's almost a definition of that type of severe autism, yeah.
Well, you know, I'll put it to, yeah, I try to say not pejorative because I consider myself to be, I mean, I choose to decompress and turn my brain feelers off when I come home, you know, even though I consider myself to be well-informed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No one likes to walk out and think of themselves as being studied as some kind of experiment. And
yeah.
I'll put it this way. A lot of us are, in the sense of the wiretapping and all that stuff, put under a microscope, and this got nothing to do with anyone of my persuasion or anyone else, but...
Sure, but your point about Bush.
But the point about Bush is that it's ironic in the sense that Bush himself is a little bit shut off from things.
Yeah, it certainly appears that way. It certainly seems that he's disconnected. In fact, that was one of the... thank you very much, Brian, for the call. That was one of the interesting observations in this poll, this new poll that just came out, was that people were saying that Bush seems like he's not connected. He's, you know, he's just definitely not connected, that there's something kind of wrong there, you know. So, anyhow, we'll see.
Now, Behind Enemy Lines.
Yes, Behind Enemy Lines, our alert for the day, our final alert for the day. The Republican talking points are out now. Democrat leaders, they say, ecstatically embrace Senator Feingold's plan to weaken the tools to fight the war on terror. This is the new frame that the Republicans are going to be using aggressively, is that Feingold is trying to weaken the tools. Now, the last I looked, breaking the law was not a tool for anything other than perpetuating crimes. The only people who used that tool were criminals. We'll see how this one shakes out, how it plays out. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Congressman Bernie Sanders' Brunch with Bernie, the longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. We'll be taking your calls. Jeffrey Kleinman from DVD Talk will be here tomorrow, reviewing the new DVD, The History of Violence. It's fascinating. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Also remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. It all begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Have you experienced a random act of kindness? Someone you haven't seen for years suddenly come back into your life? Do you know a positive story that inspired or